one bureaucrat actually told me when I asked him about vaccinations that मैडम हम 2 लाख से 40 लाख में आए हैं और आपको क्या चाहिए बच्चे की जान लोगे क्या
Hello everyone, I'm Ayushi Mona. You're listening to India Booked, a podcast where we lean into the idea of India through its literature. This podcast is perfect for you if you love reading books, like trivia, or just want to know more about India as a nation. Every podcast takes place as a conversation between the author and me, the host. When WHO first declared COVID-19 a global pandemic in March 2020, there was a great deal of apprehension about how India, the country with the highest TB cases and diabetes, inadequate health infrastructure and a population of 1.3 billion would fare. Between the Janta curfew and the first few vaccinations, a massive machinery has been working as seamlessly as possible to make sure that despite missteps and missed infections, India conquers what has been the greatest challenge the world has encountered in decades. Covering the pandemic from the very start, first for the Indian Express and then for the print, Avantika Ghosh is a senior journalist who's had a ringside view of India's battle against the pandemic. A thrilling tale of unnamed thousands battling against a little understood virus from the front lines, billions under lockdown, brings that gripping theatre and its drama to life. Join us on this episode with Avantika Ghosh as we dig deep into her book. Hi everyone, I'm Ayushi Mona, your host on India Booked, a podcast where we lean into the idea of India through books written by Indian authors. And today I have with me Avantika Ghosh. Avantika has written a fabulous book called Billions Under Lockdown. It's obviously a very, very topical book. It's extremely relevant. Avantika is a senior journalist and she's lived this life for a very, very long time, which is now translated into this book. So I am absolutely thrilled to have her here for this conversation and to understand what really went behind the scenes. Welcome to the show, Avantika, and so kicked to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me here, Ayushi. Thank you.
So, Avantika, I actually have to ask you the very first question, right? Is that how do you as an author have the wherewithal to also write a book while covering something in print as a journalist, right? Because a lot of times you're living this reality and it can be so overwhelming on so many levels.
So, see, a lot of times we are doing a lot more research than can actually come in the story that we are doing. There is already a lot of work I have done that can get translated into the book. I mean, also because it was real time, a lot of times, especially towards the second half of the book, I was actually writing things real time because the book had started and I had sort of got into it. Also, you know, honestly, leaving it wasn't that difficult when this book was written. Leaving it really became a difficult proposition in the second wave, which this book doesn't deal with. You know, this book was very stressful work-wise. I mean, I was very busy. I was like, I had no time. I'd stopped doing everything else that I love doing otherwise, apart from my work, all of those things. But I mean, when I now that I have lived through the second wave, I don't think living through was a problem here. It was more about, you know, discipline and, you know, no matter how tired you are, you sit down at night and write like for whatever time you can possibly do. So, yeah, I mean, it was difficult, but nothing like the difficult times we saw during the second wave, honestly.
And for you, right, when you started writing this book, And the byline for the book, for those listening to the podcast, is that this is the inside story of India's fight against COVID. And, you know, when I received the book and when I started reading it, I thought, okay, what do I not know about COVID-19, right? I've been, reading as much as anyone else. Also, all of us, right? This pandemic has meant that we've all lived through the lockdown together. We've all lived through the second wave. We've lived through the amount of misinformation, the changes in stance, everything that's happened, right? From banging plates to finding oxygen cylinders. So a lot of times you're like, oh my God, this is what I know. So why should I read this book? And then when I started reading the book, I realized, oh shit, I was wrong. Because a lot of how systemically, right, COVID was dealt with is what the book really captures. And for a lot of people, systemically or health systems were never really a cause of thought or concern before COVID. So for those people who don't know, for their purpose, what is a health system? Where does India today fare on them versus other countries? And what were the aspects of systemic healthcare in India that COVID exposed like never before?
So, see, India has traditionally, people like us and others who work way more in-depth in health, have been talking about how we need to increase public spending. We need to get over this over-dependence on the private sector. We've been saying that for years, and honestly, nobody paid any heed to that. It was never a priority. And also, the way it works, though it's not like a simple cause and effect, but people... A Congress politician once put it very nicely to me. He said, "Madam, why should we spend on health? Even our MP lads' funds." He said, "I am very passionate about health, and I built a 100-bed hospital in my constituency. But when I went to ask for votes, nobody cared about that hospital. They cared about roads. They cared about..." So he's from Haryana. He said, "They cared about whether I had gotten people admitted to PGI Chandigarh, which is a tertiary care center. But to have that hospital in my village meant much more in terms of a health system, because what you need is not to crowd tertiary care centers, but to really go bottom up so that, what needs to go to a tertiary care center, what is a complicated process, goes there. Everything else is taken care of down below." So I think because... for people, health was never a priority. Many more votes were got by infrastructure, industry, streets. So we never had that. And also, I think it was easier for the sort of government to just give it to the private sector. There was, pressure was less. Everything. Also, the money, really, we are still doing about 1.2% GDP. So, see, the thing is, a pandemic and so this is the first pandemic we have seen, but people who work in this sector would tell you that for years and years, I have done workshops on pandemic, and I have actually had all these conspiracy theories, people sharing stuff on WhatsApp groups saying it was predicted that a pandemic would happen and it would be a zoonotic disease and all of that. But that was known. That is how it was supposed to happen. So a pandemic was long overdue, and health system preparedness is not something you can do during a pandemic. During a pandemic, you are too busy fighting the fire. But what you need is, you need to have your fire extinguishers in place. You need to have your people, your firemen, your people who you can rope in if the fire is bigger than you anticipated. All of those things have to be done. That is what COVID has exposed. And what is extremely sad for me is that even after we went through that, this year's budget did not make the requisite investments in healthcare. The 137% hike in health or whatever it was actually translated to something like a 7 to 10% hike for the Ministry of Health. So that is the huge issue here, that the first wave was kind to us and we kind of let that get into our heads, honestly. So second wave exposed us, and now we are again talking about a third wave. So I don't know where we are headed, really.
Oh God, I think there are these there's so much that now I want to go back and pick up from the thread of multiple things you said, Abantika. But I think let me start with the fact that the first wave was kind to us, and you know, a lot of that also had to do with the brutal lockdown and the janta curfew and the kind of absolutely you know, unsolicited 4-hour lockdown that the country saw, right? And it exposed a lot of how planners or politicians or bureaucrats or the powers that might be really think about people in India, because we were just told, hey, stay where you are. But for the vast majority of this country, there is no stay where you are, right? Because for a lot of people in rural parts of India, that information does not percolate. For people in urban centers who are migrant laborers or migrant workers, and we all know what they went through. So a lot of and a lot of job losses, a lot of economic losses, etc., were concurrent, and the loss of life really got felt in the second wave. What about covering the pandemic through all of this time continues to shock you really about the systemic difference in how different classes of people, let me just call it out as that, were treated? You've touched upon it very beautifully in the book already. And for those of you, please read the book to really find out pieces around that. But as somebody who's still covering this, Abantika, what still shocks you that, okay, we never really even planned for this? And we apart from the fact that, say, there is... budgetary issues, but at a very social level in terms of how people still continue to treat certain segments of population, classes, workers. What about that still continues to amaze you that it's been so many months now and there's still no change?
No, absolutely. There has been no change whatsoever in anything. And this realization, I'll give you a simple example. COVID. How long did it take for us to say that, all right, you don't have to register with COVID, you can just walk in and get your vaccinations done, especially after we opened it up for all adults? You know, it is, I think, something like, I made that calculation. I think something like 60 crore Indians, if I'm not mistaken, have internet access. And that too, you know, there would be multiple internet accesses if you just count connections. You know, you and I have so many internet connections, right? So that was not factored in when the vaccination program was rolled out. These simple things, the fact that India does not just live in the government quarters in New Delhi. So this sort of complete indifference to how India lives, and not just indifference to how India lives, but at one level, this complete arrogance of you know, how that I am right. This kind of bureaucratic arrogance of, what I understand is the best. Nobody else knows anything. If you're critical of me, you are just against me and I don't want to listen to you. And that has gone from first wave to second wave, and I don't know how long that will continue. Another thing that I find shocking is that we refuse to learn from our mistakes otherwise also. So the book actually talks about how we would talk about deaths per million, but tests, we would say absolute numbers. Now we are doing the same thing for vaccinations. We say our cases per million is this much, our deaths per million is this much, but we have done so many vaccinations. So one bureaucrat actually told me when I asked him about vaccinations that मैडम हम 2 लाख से 40 लाख में आए हैं और आपको क्या चाहिए बच्चे की जान लोगे क्या सो आई टोल्ड हिम सर बच्चे का टारगेट भी तो देखिए ही हैज टू ओनली बिकम एन IFS ऑफिसर नथिंग एल्स विल मेक फॉर हिम ही हैज टू हैव दैट स्मॉल नंबर एट द टॉप दैट इज व्हाट ही हैज टू अचीव तो फिर तो आपको ये देखने का मतलब नहीं है ना वो कहाँ से कहाँ तक आया है यू हैव टू सी वेयर ही वॉन्ट्स टू रीच सो आई थिंक Those are the things that still shock me, and I don't think they'll change. I have very little hope now that any of this will change anymore.
One of the other things I think that's not going to change anytime in the future, and I think this is also from the previous point you were making, that a lot of people in India don't understand the value of health and investment in health. Unlike Western countries where elections are won and lost on the basis of healthcare, right? Like everything from like a Obamacare to say the NHS in UK, etc. You've also covered and spoken about how the Indian public health system contrasted with Western countries, you know, from where we were getting these updates from Italy and other parts of the world on how terribly COVID had hit them. But one of the interesting things, and I think that's never going to change, is our love for alternative medicine. And right, I think towards the beginning of the book, you call out the fact that, you know, that there were these guidelines issued. Homeopathic prophylactic medicine was distributed in Gujarat. And to date, there was this whole, I mean, wave of people advocating for all sorts of alternative therapies. Part of it is also to do with the disdain around evidence-based medicine that typically we as a country have. And I think COVID really also exposed the fact that for everyone's claiming alternative therapy or alternative medicine, they still had to come to the wonders of evidence-based modern science. They still had to reach out for a vaccination. They were admitted to hospitals for oxygen. There was shortages of all of these life-saving drugs. And that for me was also interesting. But we continue to have faith in alternative medicine. As a journalist, Abhantika, how much of, and you know, I'm sure a lot of journalists also have personal beliefs on alternative therapies working out for them. But when you're doing scientific communication and speaking to the public at large, how do you really communicate or share news for the fact that this is not going to work or this is not right when there is an obvious love for alternative medicine and that's continuously systemically also propagated, right? It's not just your mother telling you ki kadha pilo and haldi ka doodh pilo. You're being told that these are the 6 medicines, put this in your nostril, drink this on an empty stomach, everything. And then and it's crazy. Nowhere in the world did any government or any systemic recommendation come for something like this. It was only India. And it's not that other countries don't have their own systems of medicine. Alternatively, sure they do. But really, what did you think about this entire wave of alternative therapies, about Ayush recommendations, about how alternative therapies really affected the mindset that a lot of Indians had that, oh, we'll be fine because we are just boosting our immunity.
And since you mentioned it, I have a running feud with my mother on kadha and I refuse to have it. So, but see, I think it's been very difficult during the pandemic, but I think the best way to communicate science is to just put the evidence out there. Evidence or the lack of it, as in case of Ayush. But you know, even when I do that with my own friends, I stumble on this roadblock where they come back to me and say that, but it's a different system of medicine. How can you apply the same standards as allopathic medicine? Now, it is very difficult to explain to somebody that science cannot work one way for one system. I mean, if it works, so statistics, percentages, you know, confidence intervals, all of these things work the same way for everybody. It's not about allopathy, homeopathy, Ayurveda. It's not about that. So, and also, you know, your difficulty level is so much more increased, and your communication, the question of communication becomes so much more complicated when ministers, whole governments sort of, you know, put out official communication saying, please do this, this works, please do that, this works. And even now, every day, I mean, it's stopped for a while now, but every day in the briefing, we would be told by very senior doctors, CADA, PGA. So I think it's we are fighting a bit of an uphill battle, and a battle that I see us as you know, science communicators increasingly losing, because, you know, belief, government backing, all of these things are very tough to fight. Because the best I can really do is to say that this is the evidence, this is what it does. And this is the harm it can possibly do. Because Ayurveda, you know, there was this controversy recently about mercury. So a lot of Ayurveda medicines actually have mercury, and it can cause massive problems. But and the last thing that I can say is I wouldn't do this. But after that, it's really on the people. I cannot possibly convince them not to take something. Leave alone people who don't know me. I can't even convince my own friends. So I think it's a very difficult proposition, really.
Affecting behavior change is probably the most difficult thing there is. But another parallel, I think, because you said that, right, as science communicators, all one can do really is talk evidence. I think with COVID, for the first time, we really saw an upsurge in the number and the just sheer volume of journalists covering only COVID, right, for a long time. Health journalism is such a niche in India. Like, of course, there are niches like financial journalism and so on and so forth. But health is like one of the nichest of niche portions of communications. How do you, and this is out of curiosity and not really related to the book, but how do you think that as a fraternity, the media did when it came to covering COVID as a phenomenon? Because at the end of the day, this was massive, and every publication or broadcast house has a couple of health journalists, specialists at most. Or is that an inappropriate question to ask to rate your fraternity and colleagues?
Well, I think we've all kind of stuck together, and we've shared information. We have, obviously, I mean, I wouldn't share something that is exclusive to myself, but we've shared numbers, we've shared resources. Also, because it was so big, government communication, at least in the initial days, was so hyperactive. There was not much information that was left for us. It's now we are sort of going back to how we used to function. But at that point of time, honestly, we were being pelted with information all day. I couldn't really, literally, I couldn't sleep because 1:30 in the night, my phone would ping and I would actually get up to check because there may be a new case. It was that kind of thing. So, and you know, there was, all of us were new to it. There was so much pressure. So we, and even now, you know, so in the beginning, obviously, we stuck together. And even now, so, you know, I'll give a simple example. So when we go for the briefings now, they will only take so many questions. And there's no sort of, no competition about it. We just say that you ask, and we sort of, so I think all of us are mature professionals. Many of us have been doing this for years, so I don't think that was ever a problem. And the pandemic really was a very difficult situation.
Speaking of professionals, I think Abhantika, for a lot of people, they heard the phrase epidemiologist for the first time in their lives in the last few months, right? And And while I of course, because I've been following the news much like everyone else, also know about epidemiology now, but your book, and for everyone, you know, folks, please read the book. I think just for the stories of a lot of individuals who are, let me just say, unsung, right? So there is a Dr. Sujit Singh, or there is a Dr. K.K. Datta, or there is Preeti Sudhan, who is about to retire, a rock star bureaucrat. Nearly, she planned her retirement in Hyderabad, and then April she retires, and then as she's about to retire, she gets told, ma'am, you're the health secretary, we have a pandemic, and you know, and a release goes out, and this lady nearing retirement is working back-breaking hours that young people would shy and be shocked off, having to take a lot of brutal decisions, and some of these stories, right, would never say get covered, or usually discussed, right? For instance, there's this story of this one foreigner who has COVID and fever, and you know, and Preeti Sudhan in the middle of the night says, no, this is a woman, even if figure out some way, but like you have to take her to a hospital, we can't just keep shuffling her around. And she takes a lot of tough decisions, she's not media friendly. You did an interview with her, of course, and you've mentioned this in the book as well. Of course, we see politicians and we constantly saw these 8 p.m. announcements from the PM, right? And we had these state announcements, and every lockdown, every change in policy, red, yellow, green, quarantine, containment, everything. But we never really heard the story of Indian epidemiologists. We never really heard the story of these bureaucrats. So for me, I think one of the best parts of reading this book was to discover these stories and these people. For instance, the mechanism that you spoke about, right, in the book, about how data on other diseases stopped getting covered for a while because the NCDC was just working on COVID. So and say how do they operate in times when there is no pandemic? So what are the diseases that they track, you know, whether it's a chikungunya or a dengue or other, and one would never really know if India has a surveillance system or not, right? Because that's the kind of absolutely non-sexy thing that never gets covered, never gets spoken about. But to me, that was really fascinating. For you, Avantika, did you know about the bureaucratic ecosystem really well? Or is there something that you deep dive, obviously for the purpose of writing for the Indian Express and the print, but also for the book? How did bringing out these stories across the integrated disease surveillance program or a NCDC, what did that make you realize about the stories of very, very real people in our municipalities, in our bureaucracy, who actually run the machinery that makes a lot of these things possible?
So actually, I've been doing this for 20 years now, and a lot of these people, a lot of the stories I tell there are stories that were just inside me. They were not something, this was not something I learned during the pandemic. These were people I'd known for years and years. It was just a matter of sort of putting flesh and blood to those names. And I was already interacting with them on a daily basis we do stories, but that was actually one of the things that I really enjoyed doing in the book, is that we do stories, but rarely, unless somebody is retiring or something, rarely do we get to talk about the people behind those stories, people who get us those stories, or people who create those stories, create the sort of atmosphere that leads to whatever has been achieved or not achieved. We rarely tell those stories. There used to be this column in the Indian Express called the Delhi Confidential, which many people would come back and tell us that, that's my favorite column. So it was like 50 word snippets about people, about what happened behind the scenes. So for me, this book, doing this book was also about really doing a Delhi Confidential in detail also, you know, apart from writing the news, the developments and everything, I was also sharing tidbits that I know people in my fraternity know, but people out there do not know, and which people certainly find interesting, because that's why that column is so popular. So when I was writing all of this, I had that model in mind, that that newspaper, which it's such a brilliant newspaper, and you know, you people sort of read it for the stories they break, but people actually come back and tell us that this is my favorite part of the newspaper. So there's clearly a lot of appetite for this, you know, to know the people that are not there, not so much out in the open in front. So yeah, that's how. So not all of the stories that I tell in the book were actually from the pandemic. They were from before, many years. So basically perspective.
I think that you should maybe write a second book called Delhi Confidential and share these stories, because I, for one, at least found it really interesting. And also, just because, you know, when something is sort of untold, it becomes interesting. And I think that's why probably like a lot of people resonate with it also. Avantika, the second piece, which again links to this, right, is you make a lot of these, there are so many of these jargons, right, and so many of these institutions, right? Some of them, of course, are well-known, like an Indian Council of Medical Research or a National Health Mission. Then there's IDSP, there is a NHRM. There's an entire barrage of institutions, right? And I think for no other disease before this has literally every health institution and every economic institution in the country been so integrated and involved. What, from your perspective, has been one of the most interesting governance changes? You've mentioned obviously a lot of things about how this really came forward, you know, I mean, everything from like a Sunday Samvad or a Man Ki Baat, which just really became announcements that, but there was so much going on at the back end. Do you think that our governance systems were ever meant to work in such an integrated fashion as they had to do for COVID? You also already, of course, mentioned in this interview that it's not something that that you don't work on health systems when you're in the middle of a crisis, right? You work on them before, but otherwise also, even if we had the health systems in place, do you think we would have ever been ready as a country for the kind of effort it took out of every ministry and every single department really in this country to come together on this? Because I mean, right across all the criticism, and all of it very valid criticism, whether it's the fact that the country was brought down to its knees, whether the amount of posturing we did to say match up to Western countries, but do you at the end of the day feel that a lot of empathy also needs to be really given to the stakeholders who got hit by this crisis and they never knew what to do? Of course, that's true for every government in every country. I'm not saying it's exclusive to us. But just from the human side of things, did you, like, at some point of time, did you ever like look at someone, you know, while interviewing them and feel that, oh my God, I feel terrible for what this person is going through right now?
So yeah, empathy is for individuals. Empathy cannot be for a government. So in my book, I don't think I have ever sort of criticized people, as persons, individuals. It was a failure of governance. Whatever happened then, whatever happened later on, was a failure of governance. It was not because individuals were not making efforts. But the point is, even when you make efforts, you can fail. Yes, I mean, I have empathy. All of them have worked very hard. But what sort of baffles me is the empathy that they expect us to have for them is not something they show for people less fortunate than them, us, everybody else. That's that's where I have a problem. But beyond that, there's also this argument that had we been prepared, had we been pandemic prepared, had our health systems been primed, this kind of you asked if our governments were meant to work in such an integrated fashion. A government in an ideal situation should always work in an integrated fashion and not in silos. That's one. Second thing is that had we been prepared, had health systems been primed, this kind of scramble, this kind of all hands on deck may not have been required. Because, you know, and I keep going back to it, because as this was happening, there's something called One Health. It's about how you integrate governments to prepare for pandemics, how you integrate get all arms of the government working towards controlling one pandemic. And so as all of this was happening, I was extremely sort of fascinated by the similarities in the situations that had been taught to us and that we were seeing here in real life. So it's not like this was out of the blue. As I said right at the beginning, this was long overdue. And the second wave happened 3 months after we launched the vaccination. That's what exposed our real failures, actually.
Absolutely. And I think one particular line in the book is, and I don't want to quote too much from the book because I want people to read it, but one sentence is where you say that, you know, irrational fear of an ill-understood disease viewed almost as a death sentence became the hallmark of India's collective response to the pandemic. And I think that was like, you know, I think the line is, yeah, it's some 50 pages into the book, you know, and while I was reading the book and I was enjoying the initial phases, this is when I realized that I never really thought of it this way, but this is exactly what it was. In March 2020, I had an absolute irrational fear. Nobody knew anything. WHO also did not, obviously, kept changing stances. Everything was helter-skelter. There was so much information. And this was viewed like a death sentence. And a few months down the line, you know, as people started realizing that, or they started hearing of people recovering, it became all lax, right? And then people were taking Manali, Goa, wherever vacations, Maldives. And of course, as you very rightly said, that the second wave hit us after 3 months into the vaccination, right? So this line for me, I think not really a question, but just a statement, is it's probably one of my favorite portions of the book. I found it really, really hard hitting. Another thing that I really liked in the book is how you've explained a lot of these very simple terms for maybe medical professionals, but maybe not for other people, like something like a triage or herd immunity. Because a lot of things like immunity, herd immunity, triage, these started being used so interchangeably during the pandemic. And of course, combine that with WhatsApp news factories, and you have everyone who is obviously an expert on everything, and we simultaneously, at least in the middle and upper classes of Indian society, have this situation where we're very full of information which we share with all our 500 relatives, at the same time being absolutely ignorant and not really wearing our own mask or washing our own hands. I don't think I've ever socially distanced in India, whether it's traveling, whether it's buying something. I think until and unless it's been extremely like regimented somewhere that there has to be a feet distance, I don't think in the last few months or even at the beginning of the pandemic, it's something we saw. So I think a lack of civic discipline as people, which has always been the case for us as a country, right, really also makes things very difficult, even among the educated lot. And I think portions of your book where, you know, you spoke about, and this is, of course, wave one, so it doesn't cover the Kumbh piece with wave two, but say the communal issue around the Nizamuddin case, right, and Tablighi Jamaat became so big. It very, very fascinating how our socio-cultural, you know, myth and how we think affects our response to a disease. And of course, you had its own pieces where, you know, like, we never had anti-vaxxer protests, right? We have vaccination hesitancy as a country. So, I like, very, very recently, I have this relative in Kerala, and she lives in a very small village. And she told us that, you know, whenever somebody comes to vaccinate, we show him a stick and we chase him away, you know, versus like a lot of my software engineer friends in Bangalore who are busy gaming APIs to book their vaccination so that they can go on a trip with their friends and work out of the hills. It's so fascinating as a country to be living in these simultaneous realities. I think also in your book, the one other line that I really like is when you say that it is an Indian truism that no government order can ever prevent anything from happening. The more stringent an order, the more the money the system makes in its violations, right? Like, for instance, wearing masks inside your own car with the windows rolled up, right? So I found all of these different pieces so fascinating. But for you, what are some Indian truism or typical Indian behaviors, probably even humorous, that you really saw coming out of the first wave and, you know, which despite all the morbidity also made you chuckle and laugh and go like, this can only happen in our country?
Well, I think that's one, the thing about wearing your mask inside cars. It was so bizarre. Then they said you wear your mask when you're cycling. All of these things. I got into a fight with my sports complex person because he insisted that I should wear a mask and play tennis. I said, I can't do it. I can't breathe. I can't properly climb stairs in a mask. How can I play in a mask? So I think, the funniest thing about India's irrational behavior or sort of thing was obviously how all of us actually clapped and
lit diyas and banged her plate.
At one level, and not funny, it was actually very sad because the government did seem to believe that going on extending the lockdown would make the virus go away. It was pathetic, really. And there was sort of, at that point of time, I'm certain there was no understanding of what a lockdown is for. And I'm afraid even now the purpose of a lockdown in a pandemic is sort of very poorly understood. So, all of this would have been funny if we had not paid such a heavy price. But, the unfortunate bit is that, you know, it has been devastating. All of these idiosyncrasies or lack of understanding or whatever else you might call, you know, we've ended up paying such a heavy price that now, so even, you know, this thing about this kala, you know, this medicine works. Ayush ministry comes out and says this works. How does it work? You don't know. So, and then we keep saying, no, we won't take the vaccine because it's on EUA. That's the kind of sort of attitude we have, that something is around for thousands of years. We don't know what it cured, but because it's around for thousands of years, it's safe. And a vaccine which has undergone some amount of study, even if it's on EUA, that's not safe. So yeah, and we have tons of those actually. But the thing about wearing a mask in cars. Now we actually have a court order that mandates us to do that. So it's not just one part of the country. It's across government, judges, everybody is on the same page, really.
I know. And you know, there are so many portions of your book. And of course, for the listeners, right, this is not a thin book. Please don't read it with the expectation that this is a breezy read that you will finish in like an hour. It's a thick book. And there is so much, like, honestly, if I kept Avantika on to this interview for like another 6 hours, I could still go on talking to her about it. We've not discussed how the Kerala response stood out versus other countries. We've not discussed frontline workers. We've not discussed PPE shortage. We've not discussed the entire politics and madness around vaccinations, around the clinical trials. And frankly, a gazillion very, very personal stories from the different aspects, whether it was patient number 4 in Mayur Vihar versus patient number 5 in Telangana versus a little girl born in Bengaluru. There are endless stories. You have to read the book for it. Before we sign off, I want to probably tell you why you should read this book. I think you should read this book because, you know, a lot of times you are there when history is made. And with COVID-19, all of us have been there when history was made. And this pandemic hit us and it's still very much on and will only end not immediately, right? I think the book is a very, very important book to have, much like if you were, say, living in World War I and having someone give you an absolutely accurate reportage of everything that's happened. It's a book that you should keep and read for the stories, but also for a very a summarized history, really, of events. So to me, this is one of those books that you keep because it's really a moment in time put into a book that's been fabulously written and also accounts for every aspect of the pandemic as we saw it up till the cutoff time for when the book is written. And that probably means that we will have to request Avantika to write about the second wave and hopefully not the third wave, or write the Delhi Confidential book about or something called Bureaucrats in Crisis or something to that effect. But thank you so much to everyone who listened to this podcast. As I said, we could be here all day and listen to these stories. But please buy the book. It's available at independent bookstores. It's available at chain bookstores, Amazon, Flipkart, anywhere you purchase your reading from. And do follow Avantika on Twitter. Leave a review for the book if you like it. But if you're looking for something that's scientific, that's impartial, that's absolutely accurate, very well researched, and also an amazingly accurate summary of this historic moment that we are all sort of living, but also simultaneously forgetting that we're living in at the moment, it's something that you should read. Avantika, thank you so much for being on the podcast. I learned a lot, and it's absolutely an honor to interview a journalist as senior as you, because one is simultaneously worried about if one is doing a good job and also fangirling over having just finished the book. So thank you so much for your time.
Aishi, thank you so much, and I really couldn't have sort of described my book better. You've done such a great job of it. Thank you so much for that. I'm on Twitter as at Avantika77. That's Avantika77. So yeah, please do leave reviews. And thank you so much, Aishi, for having me here.
If you love listening to this podcast, do not forget to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever it is that you get your podcast fixed from. Ensure that you do not miss a single episode by following us on Twitter and Instagram. Lastly, if you have some feedback for us, we would love to talk to you. Send your bouquets and brickbats at indiabookpodcast@gmail.com.